Hey, can we time out? All right. All good dudes, stop what you're doing. This is Time Out. This is the Ortho Talk podcast. Today, we are doing a real conversation with an illustrious guest. Surgeons today are Asif Khalid and Jay Chen. Antibiotics, ANSEF, of course. What do we even ask? Fire risk, high due to lit conversations and explosive topics. Any questions or concerns? Nope. All right. We can go. Incision.
Welcome to the Ortho Talk podcast. This is episode number 24, a special Kobe Bryant edition. And with us today, we have a good friend of mine, Dr. Sunny Patel. We go back to when we were both medical students, and I rotated at the University of Texas Medical Branch for my orthopedic surgery rotation. He was a medical student there going into anesthesiology. He then went to Mount Sinai for his residency and his fellowship. He's dual certified in anesthesiology and pain medicine. He's practicing in Houston right now. So welcome, Dr. Patel.
Thanks for having me, man.
No problem. So, one of the reasons why we thought we should bring you along is because there's this huge opioid crisis in America. And you're someone who's got expertise in pain management and who's seen these kinds of problems. So let's start. What is the extent of this problem? How big of a problem is this?
I mean, the problem is huge, even by, 2002 standards. Like, I think 200,000 people had already passed away because of an opioid-related overdose. I mean, so the problem has just magnified exponentially since then. The problem is twofold, right? There's the prescription drug problem that then also leads into a, injected heroin problem. And those are two parallel stories that ran together to sort of create this like disaster in American healthcare.
So why is this such a problem in America? What led to this problem?
So most people think that like these patients or these people, these victims of this crisis tend to be because they're junkies or there's some sort of moral failing that led to it. You're hearing more and more of it be about a actual healthcare problem, and that's really what it is, because the story of opioids starts long ago, right? Like, opioids were first cultivated in Mesopotamia. They found out that the gel or the sap that comes from the opium poppy has drug relieving properties, and we've used that extensively. All the way back to the poppy.
Did you ever watch Game of Thrones?
Oh yeah, because they're on the drug, the poppy, right?
Yeah,
yeah, same thing. That's exactly what they're referencing. It has since then been used, to a good degree to treat pain. The last, 20, 30 years as surgical related, but even before that, it was only extensively used like in surgical cases. There, in the last few decades, it's been used more as a thing to treat common ailments like back pain. It was not necessarily used for that back in the day because there's this fear of addiction, because it was known to make people, pass out and for people to get addicted to the euphoria of it. The problem with the opioid crisis today is that when these drugs are marketed in opioid form, primarily in the form of OxyContin by Purdue Pharma, they really sold the fact that, it was not a, because of its extended release formula, that it was not a drug that caused a lot of addiction. And they cite a piece of, publication that was done, back in the 80s or 70s by two authors called Porter and Jick. And they essentially had done a study of patients that were, that were inpatient in the hospital and who became addicted to opioids by, opioids given in the hospital setting. And they cited less than 2%. But this was not like a study done on patients who are outpatient for ailments that are not surgical in origin or not related to surgical pain. We're talking about these opioids being used to treat things that are aches and pains that are not in the acute setting. So basically, we have a twofold story. One in which opiates are marketed as a panacea to cure pain of all degrees and from all sources and with no addiction potential. And then we have a separate parallel story in which heroin becomes cheaply and readily available in a potent form and is then used by people who cannot pay for the pills. And the people who are now addicted to the pills are not necessarily addicted because of the euphoric sense. They're addicted because they're trying to stave off withdrawal because the symptoms of withdrawal are so severe.
So have you kept up with this, the Purdue Pharma federal criminal charges that are going on?
Yeah, here and there. I mean, I've been kind of busy the last 8 months, especially with the COVID stuff going on. Our practice just got so busy, but I kind of, you know, hear bits and pieces of what's going on with them.
Yeah, so apparently the actual company is going to plead guilty to 3 federal criminal charges as part of like a huge settlement. Do you know like what did they do that was illegal? Do you know?
They knowingly misled doctors. Like that's the biggest thing. That's okay. This is not the first time they've pled guilty to something and paid a huge fine, but in a series of emails and exchanges, they've sort of proven that Purdue had known about the addictive potential of OxyContin and pushed it anyway. You know, the incentive structure for them to have these pills distributed and marketed to doctors. I mean, the Sackler family made the vast majority of their earnings since the advent of OxyContin in 1996.
So another thing I hear a lot about is the role that I think it's Jayco when they like instituted this pain is the fifth vital sign thing, and how that led to a big push to basically treat pain just to treat pain because it became like a standard for hospitals and it became a quality measure. And someone saying that their pain is 9 out of 10 would lead to problems going forward, like with the hospital credentialing and stuff. So how true is that?
Yeah, I mean, that is also linked to Purdue Pharma. They made pain a fifth vital sign so that people, there will be a demand for their drug essentially. You know, they've sponsored and In back in the 90s and early 2000s, it was kind of the Wild West in terms of, you know, pharmaceutical dinners and sort of money and marketing spent on doctors. And what they essentially did was fund a bunch of pain societies, then now advocated as pain being the fifth vital sign. But, you know, unlike the other vital sign measures, pain is pretty subjective and people's response to it is subjective. If you look across like the types of pain medications people get in other countries, like for like getting a hip replacement or something like that, you know, many of them just get Tylenol and they're fine. So we know that pain perception and the culture of pain is very distinct and kind of a risk factor for being, you know, addicted to opioids.
Right.
Let's talk about that some more. Like I heard a few years ago something like 99% of hydrocodone around the world is prescribed in the United States. So you're talking about in Europe and other places. Why is this culture of pain different? Like, are we like sissies in America, or, you know, what's going on? Why are we, what's the cultural phenomenon here?
I mean, that's a great question. You know, I'm in the belief that, you know, not only pain things, but in medicine in general, we are trying to prescribe drugs or prescribe a pill for every single ailment in our healthcare, when people don't want to do the harder, more complicated things to actually rid themselves of their ailments. You know, you just want something to sort of mask the symptoms or have it sort of an easy fix so that we don't have to think about it or put in the actual work to get better. And so pain is no different. People's expectations of what life has and the pain associated with going through certain things in life, I think is grossly disproportionate in the United States than it is in other countries. You know, people don't expect to have pain at all after like a major surgery, which is ridiculous. You would think that, you know, you should at least expect a degree of soreness after surgery. That's a reasonable expectation. But many patients, even when I'm, you know, interviewing them in my pre-op assessment, like the first question they ask is like, am I going to be in any pain? And so the reasonable answer is, of course you are. You're about to have your skin cut open and someone to work on your soft tissue for many of these surgeries. You should expect some degree of discomfort or soreness.
You know, it's interesting too. You know, within America, the patients are so different. So I don't want to violate HIPAA or anything, but you know, recently I did a few surgeries. One was a pretty big surgery on an immigrant, non-English speaking, and this person is just post-operatively just chilling in his bed, not really in any pain at all. Comparatively, I did a more minor surgery on another guy, without describing his demographics too much, but this gentleman was complaining of every type of pain you could think of, you know, immediately post-operative, and it's very interesting how people have different perceptions. I try to counsel them. This is normal to have this amount of discomfort after this type of procedure, and then, you know, it just turns into, you know, what other meds can I give them? You know, what else could I prescribe? You know, this one's not working. Let's add this one. You know, and then finally, it's like, you know what? I'm going to consult my colleagues, the pain specialist, because I'm not going down this path of adding a bunch of things. So
let me ask you, right. Jay, let me ask you this, because we're 5 weeks, maybe 6 weeks into practice now. What is your typical, like, elective surgery? What's your typical post-op pain regimen right now?
Well, so in fellowship, every patient we did, pretty much every surgery got an Exparel block. So it's long acting, a couple days, pop staff block. If done well, they don't feel any pain at all for 2 or 3 days. And when that immediate period of pain is over, in fellowship, we gave them oxycodone. And then here at UTMB, we give Norco, so hydrocodone, Tylenol. But, you know, basically in fellowship, we prescribe, I think, 2 weeks worth of meds, and that's all we were allowed to prescribe per institutional policy. So that's all we gave.
So what's your policy then?
So right now, I push for the block, and this is something else we can talk about these blocks, because I've gotten pushback about blocks too. Apparently, Exparel is not approved for a PopSap block from the FDA. So I've had most of the faculty I've worked with have been okay doing the block, but there's been occasional faculty that have said they wouldn't do that block for me. So so most of the time they do have that block available, and I prescribe Norco, about 3-4 weeks worth of Norco, and I have a hard kind of policy where after that period of time I'm not very willing to re-prescribe the Norco. And then, you know, luckily I haven't had patients yet. I've only been in 5 weeks, so I haven't had patients that are 2 or 3 months out demanding for more Norco. But I imagine that's going to happen at some point. And then, you know, I was going to ask Sonny here, you know, when, as a pain medicine guy, when is it appropriate to refer to you guys for post-surgical pain?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you're right. Like, you try to do everything you can during the time of surgery, right? You're going to do a multimodal anesthetic most of the time. That's what everyone's pushing for. So you're going to do things like regional nerve blocks. You're going to use acetaminophen. You're going to use maybe ketamine intraoperatively. You're going to get, you know, other adjuvant analgesics, you know, Cymbalta, gabapentin, Lyrica, any of these other drugs to sort of minimize your use of opioids. A lot of surgeries are now moving towards like the enhanced recovery after anesthesia and surgery protocols, right? In which they're getting drugs by mouth, Tylenol plus gabapentin, even Celebrex before their surgery to cut down the amount of opioids they'll need afterwards. The blocks, you're right. The maximum they're probably going to last by themselves is probably about 2 days. And if you've already tried getting all these things, right, going down things that are non-opioid related, like Tylenol, gabapentin, Lyrica, then escalating to, you know, tramadol, which is a partial opioid agonist, and then escalating maybe to hydrocodone, and then you're starting to see that your patient's requiring, you know, escalating doses of opioid medication. That's probably the good time to contact your pain manager once you've sort of tried all these other modalities.
Yeah.
So what's your thing? What do you do?
So I instituted 6 weeks max for my post-op narcotics. I'm thinking of cutting that down to maybe 4 or even 2, but it's for some surgeries at least. But I lay that out at the very beginning when I see them before surgeries. I will prescribe this. Basically, I tell them, like, you know, this is the amount I prescribe. And this is what I think you should use. If you need more, I will prescribe it up to 6 weeks. And after that, you need to see your PCP or your pain management doctor. But for me, I'm still playing around with it. I do a little bit of multimodal, especially, well, pretty much for every surgery. I do Celebrex before and during the postoperative period, because I think Celebrex is the one NSAID you can take, you know, in the periop period without worrying about bleeding. So I do Celebrex 200 BID. I usually use Norco. That's my go-to. We did a little bit of Percocet in fellowship, but I think Norco is probably a little milder. So I do Norco, and the amount I give really depends on the surgery. So, you know, I was watching a couple other webinars on, you know, the different postoperative pain regimens for different surgeries. And some people are giving like maybe, you know, 10 pills or, you know, 15 pills total for a knee scope. So I'm playing around with it just to see what the population around here can tolerate and what the average is really going to be. So for carpal tunnels, I usually only give like 5 or 10 pills total. And I'll tell them like, hey, this is what you should probably be taking. And if you need more, let me know. But, you know, this is about average what people take. For something bigger, like a rotator cuff repair, I might do, you know, 30 a week supply, something like that. But really, I think that's beneficial for two reasons. One, you're reducing the waste of narcotics and you're reducing the resale. And two, you take away the incentive to use the narcotics, because when they have them laying around and, you know, it's readily available for them, they'll take more. So if you limit it, I think one, they tend to space it out a little more because they don't want to run out. And two, they're not as incentivized to take narcotics around the clock. So the one thing I'm really playing around with right now is co-prescribing Norco and Tramadol, because that's what we did in fellowship. We would get both Norco and Tramadol. I'm starting to push towards one or the other instead of both at the same time. I don't know. What do you think, Sonny? What should I do?
No, that Tramadol don't work.
Yeah, you're going to get a lot of patients say that. You know, some people will work, you know, beautifully for them, and others, yeah, like, just won't. They just have the genetic variant that doesn't metabolize it well into, you know, the active form. I don't know if prescribing both them together is going to be beneficial or not, because, you know, Tramadol is a partial agonist, right? So you're going to have some level of receptor competition, mm-hmm, with a pure mu agonist. So you're not going to get, even when if you give the hydrocodone on top, right, that hydrocodone is going to have to compete with Tramadol to offset, mm-hmm, it off the receptor to have its full effect.
Right.
So yeah, I would stick with just one and go up.
Is there any benefit to alternating between? Like.
I don't really think so. I mean, you get some degree of benefit from the fact that Tramadol has other activity, mm-hmm, other than mu opioid activity to help with some of the pain there. But in terms of like pure mu opioid agonist strength, like, yeah, it's not going to have, they're not going to have the same effects. And alternating them, you may save off some level of tolerance, but,
right,
you know, I don't think you're going to build up that tolerance that quick, you know, in a few days or anything like that. Right. It's going to occur like a period of weeks or things like that. But I think you're on the right track in terms of, you know, not giving a whole lot of it, because the first 2 days of surgery are typically the most painful, right? Mm-hmm. And then there is a drop-off period. So I think you're right in getting patients into the mindset of like, hey, take this medication if things are unbearable. If things are tolerable and you can move around and you can get some degree of sleep, like, that is a normal expectation after surgery. Right. So I think, you know, we talked about for surgery, right? You guys do an assessment and see what the patient selection is for that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you're seeing, is this patient a good candidate for having this surgery done? Are they going to even perceive a good benefit from it? Or are they going to continue to feel debilitated and not do well after surgery because they also had the surgery? And part of that is evaluating the coping mechanisms, right? If people have good coping mechanisms, they will obviously do better after surgery because they'll be able to understand and rationalize their discomfort. As to people who have unrealized expectations or bad coping mechanisms, where they want to just take a pill real quick if they feel the slightest bit of discomfort.
So guys, I've been thinking a lot about the issue of anxiety in America. It's just like you're talking about coping mechanisms, like, I guess, interesting, medical training is like a time warp, right? You start medical school, go to residency, now you finish fellowship and you're at the end of your time warp and you're like, oh, I'm practicing in the real world. I still remember like college like it was yesterday. I feel like that was right before I entered the time warp. And, you know, I was really not aware that so many people in America had anxiety, you know, when you're in college. But then you go through your training and you just see it everywhere. in patients, family members, people who work in the hospital. It's like, it's an epidemic as well. So just like you're saying with coping mechanisms, what I've been thinking a lot about, what's the role of psychologists, psychiatrists, counselors, coaches, preoperatively for patients that are about to undergo a big surgery. You know, what can we do as surgeons to help our patients get better mentally prepared for what they're about to go through? What do you guys think about that?
So I think this is something we touched about a little bit before. And as surgeons, there's not a lot we can do because we see them maybe 2 weeks post-op, 6 weeks post-op, or maybe 10 minutes, you know. We don't see them very often, but therapists, the PTs and the OTs that we send them to, like, you know, they see them multiple times a week. But they really are, like, you know, kind of the coaches that guide them through the post-op period. I think a lot of that responsibility falls on them. So a good therapist, I think, can make a big difference with something like that.
Yeah, I agree. I think physical therapy is a big thing that people need to take seriously. I mean, I think people should have a physical therapist or have access to a physical therapist in their regular life, because so much of what we do, you know, sets us up for having body pain in different joints just because of the way we move. And you have to have a physical therapist. It isn't just like just push on the patient a little bit or just put some ultrasound on them. You got to have somebody who actually cares to take them through a full range of motion for something, right? Someone who cares to like strengthen accessory muscles like the gluteus to set off some imbalances in their hip and knees. Yep. For orthopedics, I think it's like incredibly crucial to partner up with a really good physical therapist.
And that's one thing I found helps a lot too, is that if I'm planning a surgery that's going to require an extensive PT course afterwards, or even not, like, you know, whether it's a cuff or like a knee scope, I still send them to PT afterwards. One thing I found that helps is sending them to PT before their surgery so that they can meet the therapist and the therapist can go over the plan and kind of set some expectations as to what they're about to go into. That way, you know, when you don't want the first time they're seeing this post-op plan to be immediately post-op when they're in pain and when they're hurting, right? You want them to see it before so that they know, I'm going to be doing this for a couple weeks. It's going to hurt this much. This is usually how long it takes to get over. I think it kind of sets the groundwork. And when people have an expectation and they're not caught by surprise, I think that can help too, reducing that anxiety.
I think that's a great point. I mean, nobody wants to listen to somebody move them through a range of motion that's painful, like immediately post-op.
Yeah.
Like they want to have some sort of built-in trust and familiarity with somebody so that they can accept that plan, right? I think, you know, in terms of what Jay was saying about, you know, getting, you know, some sort of psychological or psychiatric evaluation done, I've seen a few doctors do that before they have like a spinal cord stimulator placed or something like that with some of my colleagues. It's not a bad idea. I think you're right. Like the coping mechanisms and the, you know, the baseline anxiety that a lot of patients have sets them up for failure in terms of dealing with and responding to and working through their rehabilitation after surgery. So I think that if you see that as a physician, like that's something that you also have to think about, like, do I want to do surgery on this patient right now? Or do I need to get them better teed up? But it's hard, right? Because you're like, the patient got sent to me for this problem. I can fix this problem. They want this problem fixed. They're gonna not gonna be happy about having to go through some other hoops to get their surgery done, right?
Yeah. And how do you like bring that up to a patient? Like, hey, I wanna fix you. I'm just not quite sure if you're mentally there. You know, like
It's hard, especially as like a specialist, right? Like the patients are your patients in the sense that they get referred to you initially, but they're not somebody you necessarily have known for, you know, a long time or something most of the time. So I think like you can, if you have a few visits before you actually recommend surgery, which is not many things. You can only do that for like arthritis related stuff.
Yeah.
If someone's an acute injury, you kind of have to do surgery on them soon. So if you have a patient that you actually see that has a non-acute ailment, I think they're the people that you can sort of guide through that process because you can develop some sort of relationship with them. But the, on the acute setting, man, I don't know. That's hard to do. I really don't have a real answer for that.
Interesting. All right, Sonny, let's take a step back into the opioid crisis again. You know, someone that we've talked about kind of what's going on talked about maybe why people are more prone to going, you know, going towards an opioid addiction. What are some things we can do as individual providers, and what are things we can do as a society? If you were in charge, you know, how can we turn this around? Because, you know, I don't really know if there are a lot of positive steps being taken.
So things were sort of on the right track, like before prescription opioids became a big thing. Like, but they were hard things to do. You know, there was a doctor that would work with you through, like, you know, intense physical therapy for, you know, strengthening yourself, giving the long-term things that we tell our patients to do, like diet, exercise, you know, losing a few extra pounds, things like that. These are things that ultimately will solve a lot of their ailments when it comes to aches and pains of the body, right? Doing mobility exercises, stretching, yoga, all these things play some sort of role there. And that's sort of where things were headed until a pill got introduced that said that this will solve everybody's problems. So to get back to that is going to be pretty hard. People who are already on opioids, their mu receptor is never going to be the same as it was before mm-hmm. they were on opioids. They may require some degree of maintenance opioid the rest of their lives if they've been on high doses. So for the next generation of people, these are the people we have to sort of cultivate. And as practitioners, it's tough, right? Because these things get set into motion early in people's lives, the anxiety, the depression, the coping mechanisms. So until we figure out some societal problems, like, you know, where people don't get anxious about things, the way we parent our children, the societal problems that are going on right now, for that not to stress out our young people, I don't know if we're going to have a culture that doesn't immediately go toward an easy fix or a way to numb their feelings.
I think a lot of that falls back on the PCPs too, right? Because a lot of times, especially with orthopedic patients, I'm the first one that's telling them they need to lose weight. I'm the first one telling them that, like, how to actually lose weight. And for some reason, a lot of that is lost in primary care because it's, you know, it's like you said, it's a quick fix, right? Put them on a statin, put them on blood pressure medicine, you know, just get things under control, because they might never lose the weight. They might never get into exercise. So at least this way you're kind of controlled and you know it, right? But for us, that makes a big difference. I mean, you know, a few pounds here and there could be the difference between, you know, a successful surgery and a non-successful surgery, depending on what surgery you're doing. So, I think it's the same way. And I totally agree about the pre-op opioid use. I think a lot of our studies have shown that pre-op opioid use just leads to worse functional outcomes and patient-reported outcome measures. So it's definitely a risk factor for having a worse surgery outcome. And that's why I don't personally prescribe opioids for anything other than post-op pain. And that's been a change in my training too, right? When we started training, I think hydrocodone wasn't even a, you know, controllable two substance. So you didn't need a triplicate to write it. And then that changed. And you know, we used to give Norco for everything, fractures, for arthritis, for any pain that was uncontrolled. And it's really been over the last couple of years that this has been a big paradigm shift.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing that's going to be strange for you guys. I think it's appropriate for you not to prescribe so much and just think about the immediate postoperative period and to get them through that. I think you're on the right track in thinking that.
I think it's also. It's something I didn't realize before, is that a lot of this stuff you can treat without pain, like without opioids, and just pain, like, right? Pain can go away without opioids. And like you can have a fracture and you'll survive. Pain doesn't kill people, right? And that's
it's hard to say that to your patients who are like, this is killing me. You know?
Well, then let's tie this into Prescini scores. Then.
Yeah, I knew you were going to go there.
There's the pressure. Yeah. I knew I was going to go here. But, like, you know, a patient comes into my clinic with a fracture and, they're just telling me, I tell them the problem. I tell them what I can do. Maybe I recommend non-op. And, you know, but doctor, what about pain? All the, you know, what they gave me in the ER, I already ran out of that. You know, what are you going to give me for pain? And then, you know, you tell them, I only give opioids. I only give pain meds after I do surgery. And then they just tear you up on an online review. You know, I came to the doctor for a problem and they didn't treat my pain. They just let me out of the office with nothing but a boot or whatever it is, you know, like you get torn up. for that. Well,
at some point, you got to take a stand on what you're going to take, right? Either you accept those reviews for what they are and you live with it, or you contribute to an opioid crisis. You tell me, Jay, what do you want to do?
Yeah, I'm gonna
I mean, it's simple when you put it like that, right? No, but like, yeah, I mean, look, you got to do your best to educate the patient that, like, you know, what you're doing is for their benefit. Yeah, you might be treating their pain now, but you're setting them up for never having their pain, you know, improve over the course of their lifetime. And so I try to, like, inform patients of the incredible risks that come with opioid, you know, addiction and abuse. And they don't, it's not like they want to do it, but it's something that they will be pushed into doing by the nature of tolerance in this drug, right? But yeah, I mean, you're going to have to take the L on that one, you know. your press gain scores are going to have to go down, because it's just the way it is, man. There's no good system. There's no, like, just like everything else, there's no easy fix. We're in a system that doesn't incentivize.
Because I passed it out, yeah.
System of reviews and stuff is not, like, good for us as doctors.
I mean, they should, you know, one of the quality measures should be the amount of narcotics you prescribe. That should be a quality measure. And that's actual quality of, I mean, obviously, you know, patients have different baselines or whatever, but I forgot where I was going with this. I had a point and then I forgot it. So someone can keep going.
All right. So I'm gonna hit on a point that you talked about, though. It's like, you know, we put a lot on PCPs to be the people to, you know, deal with these sort of overlying issues, right? But I don't want to take a straight up dump on them, because their job is, like, ridiculously difficult now, right? In order for them to even make ends meet, they have to see, like, 40 patients a day.
Right.
And it's easy to be like, hey, I need to actually treat the things that actually matter in this patient and get them to listen to me. So I'm going to hand out this drug so that they can actually listen to what I actually want them to do. And so they're in a tough spot, right? Like, where they don't have the time, resources, or attention from patients to understand what they need to do for them to get better. And so a lot of this falls on being an educated patient in general. You have to understand, to have some degree of the healthcare system and some degree of your own health. You can't be the patient that doesn't know what medications you're on. You can't be the patient that neglects all your other issues or doesn't take an active role in solving them. So I don't want to put all the pressure on the PCPs. I want to put it back on the patients, because at some point, we are not the people that are there to solve all your problems. We're there to help you through your problems and get you to a better place. We're partners in your healthcare. We're not like we're not your, you know, plumber who's going to come by and, like, fix the pipe and then that's it, right?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. And maybe I was a little too harsh on PCPs, but I do think we need to kind of, you know, if you're in a hospital system, Sunny, are you in a private group, or where are you?
I'm in a private group, and I'm not in, like, in a major inpatient hospital. We have, like, surgery centers is my most common practice model.
So for, like, me and Jay, where we're integrated with PCPs and emergency rooms and stuff like that, I think it's worth setting up a system where you have to collectively agree what you're going to prescribe opioids for. Because Jay, you said this before, when they go to the ER and they get a script for a short course of narcotics, and then they come to you for follow-up, and then you say, well, we're going to do this, this, and this. And they respond with, well, what are you going to do for my pain? I ran out of my pain medicine. And you say, well, I'm not going to, you know, I don't prescribe that. And then they get pissed off at you, right? And then you have to try to explain them that, like, well, I'm this is what we're doing for pain. I'm, you know, giving you an injection, or we're going to do surgery for the pain. Narcotics aren't a good fix for pain. But if you kind of hold, and it takes work on our part, but if you kind of, you have to form a collective with the people who see these patients too and say, look, this is what we're going to prescribe narcotics for. This is an acceptable use of narcotics. And you have to have your anesthesia department involved too, right? Because, I mean, those are the people you send the patients to if you need actual, you know, pain management stuff. So I think that can help too, especially in the emergency room setting, because I see that a lot is that they'll get a short course of narcotics and then they get pissed off because you're not going to keep it going. And, you know, they don't want to be in pain. Nobody wants to hurt. So,
I mean, it's a good idea, but getting the whole department to buy into a pain policy can be, you know, we know doctors that we
train. It's really tough. Yeah, it's really tough.
Who will just prescribe for...
It's hard to do it within the orthopedic department.
Exactly. So, I don't know. It's a good idea, but surgeons like their autonomy still, you know?
So there's autonomy stuff, and just like to get everybody together and for all of us to like put our foot down and be like, hey, this is not an appropriate use of, you know, opioid pain medications to like all the patients is going to be difficult because you don't want that disruptive patient in your ER. You don't want that disruptive patient in your clinic, right? It's not good for even your, even selfishly, it's not good for your reputation if you have patients that are being belligerent in your offices, right? Mm-hmm. So it's, we have a lot of pressure to give in to handing out the drugs and handing out, you know, a little short course of opioid pain medications here. But I don't know. We are all going to have to collectively just going to have to suck it up and not put our, and just put our foot down and not acquiesce to patients, because once they see one provider, you know, give in, they expect all of us to give in.
Right.
So Mo, do you ever make exceptions?
I haven't yet.
Do you ever plan to?
I haven't yet. No, I've been pretty strict about it. I think we've had to, from our department, has had to fire one patient already for just repeated narcotic requests, you know? And I, but you know, that was a long story. I think it had more to do with him badgering us for narcotics, but but no, I've actually been pretty strict, and patients haven't really given me much pushback once I explain it to them. Once I kind of sit down with them, and I've had this conversation plenty of times with them, but you just kind of sit down and be like, look, if I give you narcotics before surgery, it's not going to work after surgery. And then your pain is going to be too tough to control. And once you kind of say that to them, they get it, right? They kind of understand that, and they don't really give you a lot of pushback. And, you know, it's also helpful because I'm not booking out months in advance right now. So patients don't have to wait months for the surgery and live in pain for months. So we'll see what happens once that, you know, if that gets to that point. But once you kind of tell it like that, people seem to understand.
Yeah. And, you know, for primary care patients and for primary care providers, you know, they're going to be bearing the brunt of this problem, right? Because the patients are not going to be able to get to see a pain management expert all the time, right? You know, just depending on where you live or, you know, how busy or the density of where you live, or just the sheer number of providers you might have in the area. So primary care providers are unfortunately going to have to learn how to wean people off those opioids. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are safe ways to do it. And just familiarizing yourself and being stern with patients, being like, look, me and you have this agreement. I'm going to pursue, you're on this high dose of opioids, right? You're going to feel better when you get off of them because your body will be able to reset and live in a more normal physiologic state. And so you have to form a pretty hard agreement and contract with them. Like, this week, this is how many you get. Next week, this is what I want you to do. And the week after, we're just going to keep going, escalating down further and further and further while you have other modalities like physical therapy, and, you know, the use of other injections or spinal cord stimulator or other things that can help with pain sort of come on and take the place of the opioids, right? A lot of my pain colleagues say that once they have been able to, you know, wean people off opioids, the patients actually feel much better and are grateful for us not having them dependent on the clock and like on the pills. Mm-hmm. You know, their life just frees up more. People's mood is completely integrated into their perception of pain. We're anxious, more pain. You know, if we're stable, not anxious, able to rationalize our thoughts, we accept things much better.
That's a good point. So what goes into a pain contract? Because that's a term we throw around a lot that I don't think as orthopedists we really understand. So when you're setting up a pain contract with someone, what does that actually entail?
It usually has, you know, language written in such that like the patient agrees that they're going to come in for every time they come in for prescription, they're going to get a drug test, or they're going to be going for a drug test before their prescription. That they are going to, you know, understand that they're going to get de-escalating doses of opioids. And, you know, if they are found to have, you know, either opioids in their bloodstream or even a more concerning sign, no opioids in their bloodstream, which means that they're probably dealing out the pills that you're giving them, that is the termination of like that physician patient relationship. You can give them other people to, you know, help with their addiction and give them resources to do so because you don't want to abandon the patients. But, you know, carrying on that relationship of, you know, essentially feeding a patient's addiction is not appropriate. You're doing more harm than good at that point.
What options does a patient have after they break a pain contract?
they can find another provider who's willing to take on their prescribing. They can see a addiction specialist. They can check themselves into inpatient rehab or outpatient rehab. I'm not saying that any of these things are particularly easy or that they're, you know, financially viable every time, but these are the options they have. This is the sad reality of the state that they're in, is that these are the options that they will have.
What do you think about state mandates to cap the amount of opioids we can prescribe?
I mean, it's a mixed bag, right? It on one hand, like, practitioners nowadays are scared to prescribe any opioids at all, right? Like when I trained in fellowship, like many of my trainings didn't take on any new prescription of opioids. And when they took on patients who had opioids, they de-escalated them very quickly in terms of their doses. So, I mean, the mandate on a cap, like there's not a one size fits all for patients. Some patients start on a high dose. You inherit them on a high dose. So you can't just take them off. They're going to go into withdrawal.
Right.
So the understanding has to be that you're going to come off these opioids. Between any practitioner and the patient, the understanding is that I'm not going to continue prescribing this. I'm going to start cutting you down week by week by week. It's not going to be a constant dose of medication.
Interesting. All right. So, Sonny, you're the first anesthesiologist we've had on the show. So,
and the first anesthesia delay we've had.
And the first anesthesia delay we've had.
Yeah, it's fitting, right?
I was going to ask about that. Why do you guys delay us so often? Like, what's the deal with that?
To make your life miserable and to get some sort of, you know, sick, twisted satisfaction out of that.
That's what I figured. break down the time you spend behind the curtain on Amazon and on gaming, on surfing the web, and then on actually taking care of the patient. Break it down for us.
Oh, wow. You don't think I have to get the patient the whole time. Great. I'm already starting off from a low place. Okay. So, When you undergo anesthesia residency, right, the thing you're doing is you're learning to interpret and analyze background information at all times. So, for instance, like when you have a monitor beeping, right, that beeping tells you several things. Like one, it tells you the rate of the beeping, which is your heart rate. The tone of the beeping tells you the saturation. If it's a high pitch, you're saturating well. If it's starting to lower down, I mean, something's going wrong and you better look at the monitor. If there's a separate beep for when the blood pressure cuff goes off. So all these things, like even when if I'm sitting in an OR and I'm like looking at my phone, every few minutes I'll glance up at the monitor or I'll be, you know, in the background interpreting this information so that you're able to recognize patterns based on these sounds and things like that. Obviously, if I hear a bunch of suctioning like on the other side, I know something might be going wrong too. And so like I'll perk up and I'll take a look and see what's going on, or I'll ask you what's going on, you know? So the amount of time, it may seem like anesthesiologists don't do anything because the vast majority of the time, you know, we're picking patients in the outpatient setting that'll survive the outpatient anesthesia ambulatory surgery center. So like they're going to be fine and I don't have to do a whole lot of active management of things. But there's always like, if I don't have like the analyzer in my brain on at all times, like, you know, like I'm not going to have a successful career. So most anesthesiologists have that. Otherwise, you're not going to get far in residency.
That's good. That's insightful. Do you guys prefer names other than "Hey Anesthesia"? Or
yeah, I mean, it really helps to be a person, like, and not just a, you know, just a noun. I think our generation is much better at this, though. Like, you know, like me, you, Asad, like if we all train together, we know what to respect in each other's field, right?
Right,
like,
right.
You're not going to tell me to like, hey, you know, why don't you put an LMA in instead of this tube? And I'm not going to tell you, why don't you use the 2-0 Vicryl instead of like the nylon, right?
Right, right.
Like we know each other's lanes and we respect each other's like expertise in that field. And our residencies allow us to train with each other in each other's rotations, right? I think that's really beneficial because that's where you develop the relationships between, you know, different specialties to become friends and really trust one another. You know, old surgeons, like anesthesia was just some garbage like technician that did their bidding, right? And that they were in old ORs, like you hear these horror stories of like surgeons like mistreating everybody there. I think our generation is more level-headed and, you know, we have a life outside medicine. So yeah. we're podcasting. Better attuned with each other. Yeah, we're podcasting. We're friends. We like to do other stuff. And we care about each other as people more than older surgeons did. So I think it's improving in general. Like our relationship is like of colleagues. Like you trust what I do. I trust what you do.
Absolutely. What else? Oh, let's talk about turning the table and airplaning it. So is that a lot of work for you guys? If I'm asking you to airplane the table like 5 times during a case, or are you guys just like whatever?
I mean, you might get some sighs of frustration. Like, God, man. I'm like this. You know, 30 minutes into Game of Thrones. Just let me finish.
Yeah.
with all joking aside, no. I mean, like usually, if the surgeon's friendly, like no anesthesiologist is gonna really complain too much. Even the ones that take forever to do something, as long as you're nice to everybody in the OR, most of us don't really mind, unless you're keeping us there till like 9 p.m. Because then you know, might get some like. Some yeah, size of frustration there as well.
The most trouble I got in last week was when I finished a case at 1:30 instead of 2:30 because it meant they had to go to an add-on. So then I got like dirty looks the rest of the week.
Yeah, the hospital setting is like that, man. You play like sometimes when you're a resident, you play some games. You're like, oh, just suture a little more carefully. Yeah. Just take a little bit longer so you don't have to do like the emergency like category one that's coming in.
Yeah,
it's, you know, residency is funny. Like there's a lot of games that you play to like make your life not a living hell, you know.
Yeah, I get dirty looks all the time. I mean, not because I'm mean, but because like I adjust the table like crazy, like especially during knee scopes, because it totally matters for me just because my height and like I just got to get leverage like cranking on the knee and stuff. So people are always like, I don't know. It's kind of, I feel bad about it sometimes, but then again, I don't really.
So I do too. Like when we prep the leg, we drop the table so it's easier to hold, and then we raise the table to our operating height. And then for the foot, you have to work, you know, medial, laterally, kind of on all sides sometimes. So I'm airplaying the table left to right, and then my resident's in there, and my current resident's like a foot shorter than me, so I drop the table down, and then when I want to do something, I raise the table up, and I'm always looking back like, man, these guys must hate me so much right now.
No, I mean, they'll get used to it, man. Like, look, when you sign for anesthesia, it's part of the job. That's the joke, right? Table up, table down, I'll do whatever you want. Like, once you get into private practice, like, the other things in your life sort of become better. So, or once you, like, graduate residency, your life becomes better. So, you're just more accommodating and more accepting of your circumstances. You don't think about it as a chore. As opposed to like, you know, staying up till like 8 p.m. the night before and like, ah, this bastard just keeps going to that. I just want to sit here for a little bit, you know, like it ends up being different because you realize that, you know, your work life will be significantly better than your residency life.
What are some of the other medicines that we give before surgery that makes your life easier? Like TXA, do you notice like a difference when we use TXA and when we don't, as far as like,
I think TXA is pretty good, especially for the ortho side. Like TXA works pretty well, I think.
Yeah.
Most of the knee surgeons that I work with or the hip replacements that we do, they all use TXA. Mm-hmm. We used it pretty often for big spine cases at Sinai. Yeah. I mean, I like it whenever you guys try to stop bleeding from happening. It's good. It makes my life easier. Other medications that you guys do, like, I think just like when you give patients a realistic expectation of the post-op stuff, that's obviously helpful. In terms of medication-wise, the ERAS stuff, like, yeah, cutting down opioids is going to help me intraoperatively, not give so much.
Right.
Let's see.
Does Dexedrine help at all?
With what part? With pain?
I guess, yeah. I know some people give Dexedrine. I don't really – I've never really – Jay, do you use it at all? Yeah.
We usually give some Dexedrine in the IV. I don't know about you guys, like in the field. Like some people do. Yeah, you're right.
Oh,
like,
no, we don't give it in the field. Actually, I don't know. I guess some people do it in the box.
I've seen podiatry do it more often. Like they put Dexedrine like in their local anesthetic or whatever.
Oh, that's interesting. What about ketamine? Ketamine is a hot topic right now. At least for us.
Ketamine is pretty useful. Like especially intraoperatively, it definitely cuts down the amount of opioids that you have to give. A lot of cases we do for like plastic surgery at my surgery center, like we don't give any opiate for some of those plastic surgeries. Ketamine takes care of all of it. On the flip side of it though, those patients might be like zonked out a little bit longer like in the recovery room, which will then make the recovery room nurses mad.
Yeah.
So you have to balance it. I think giving ketamine up front rather than giving so many doses in the middle of the case is better. Or if you cut off your infusion, you know, at least like 2 hours before, at the very least, your end of surgery, assuming your surgery is not like 10 hours long, you know. Other analgesics, like we have some guys like NSAIDs, like Celebrex, you give pre-op, or we can give Ketorolac in the operating room. I think most of the time, you guys want us to avoid that just for bleeding reasons and for like a bone healing delay, right?
Yeah, some people believe in that.
Yeah.
What about IV Tylenol? Is that just an expensive myth, or does IV Tylenol actually work better than PO? So I think the studies say that PO actually, and there's no difference between PO and IV, right?
That's absolutely right. Like, there's no difference between PO and IV in terms of the overall pain control that you're going to obtain. But just like any drug that's given IV, you just feel it a lot faster. Uh-huh. So if you're giving a patient that's awake IV Tylenol, like, that medication is immediately in their bloodstream, doesn't have to go through the absorption or the first half metabolism. And so it's going to work more readily than the PO will. But if you're giving it before surgery, right. It's not going to matter. It's going to be like absorbed during surgery. You'll have the full effect.
Yeah, because I think some people do give IV Tylenol before surgery, and I guess it's just a waste of money at this point.
Yeah, but I think if you're trying to cut down costs, and I think a lot of hospitals and surgery centers definitely try to do that now, giving PO is just as good.
Yeah.
Do you guys prefer those on-cue pumps, those indwelling catheters, versus a single-shot block?
Oh, yeah, there's a good topic.
No, we don't.
Because I don't either, but it seems like people want to push for those. Like, I like the single-shot block, but...
Yeah, so the problem with single-shot blocks, right, depending on what kind of vascularity you have, where you're putting the block in, it's not going to last like 24 hours or more a lot of times. It's the last thing you want if you're getting surgery at the beginning of the day is to wake up with the pain afterwards. So there's a couple things you can do to ameliorate that, right? One, the surgeons can use Exparel, although it's not FDA approved for anything other than interscalene blocks, right?
Right.
You can add Decadron to long-acting local anesthetics. It'll extend it for, you know, a couple to several hours. That's really it. The catheter is just there so that it lasts for 2-3 days. But man, getting that, if you have to get that stuff set up all on your own, like put the medication into the pump, like you have to do it out in like ambulatory surgery centers.
Yeah.
I'm just like jamming this 50 cc syringe in for like 6-7 times, you know. It's annoying. I think
when we're taking the drapes down, like, I always hear stories about the catheter being pulled out. I've never done it myself, but I've always heard stories about it. But so let's talk about, why is Exparel not approved yet? Why am I getting pushback on my Exparel blocks? This is making me upset. I don't know. It's making me upset.
It's making me upset too.
Okay, I started here, I'm like, oh, this is what I want. In fellowship, we do this for every case. And then here the people are pushing back.
Oh, my God.
I'm not comfortable with this. It's not approved. I'm like,
it's mostly insurance, man. It's all insurance.
I just did 400 of these. I just did 400 of these last year. Like, you know.
I know. Somebody's got to pay for it. And insurance says, no, it's going to fall on you or the patient. So, I mean, if your patient's willing to accept the cost of it, you can easily do it, right? Otherwise, it's going to come out of your bottom line and make things not economical.
The Duke population, that's it. That's the key. That's why. All right.
Exactly. Patient population is everything, man.
Is it going to change, though? Is it going to be FDA approved at some point?
Yeah, I mean, I think that when the more and more studies come out that it actually, like, you know, if they do tend to show that the blocks last longer, some of them don't, and some of them think it's a gimmick. Tell me something. When you prepare the Exparel, right, are you also mixing in regular bupivacaine with it?
I don't know. I'm not preparing it myself, so I just ask
okay. Because one of the concerns is that if you just give regular bupivacaine with the Exparel also, that it's gonna the actual lysosomal component leaches out and you're not gonna have the real block.
Interesting. So why don't they could just do it without the, you know, bupivacaine?
Well, yeah, I mean, unless it comes like a prepared formulation, right? Then you just use that crap, but don't combine it with any extra bupivacaine outside of that.
All right, next one, I'll be sure not to combine them. All right.
Wow, really want to take out that one, huh?
Good advice. No, that's good though. That's good to know though.
Here's the thing with blocks, right? There's a whole camp of surgeons that are totally against blocks. And the reason why is because there's let's just say inner scaling blocks, for example, right? What do you think like the true incidence of like a diaphragmatic paralysis is in an inner scaling block? Because I think the literature quotes it like 1% or less, right? Somewhere around there.
You're going to have some level of phrenic nerve palsy. Like
right.
Usually if you're giving 25 to 30 cc's of local anesthetic in your inner scaling, the phrenic nerve usually does get affected. What matters is that what patient are you doing it on, right? If you're doing it on some healthy 22-year-old,
it doesn't matter.
Like, yeah. It's not that big of a deal. Not big of a deal because, like, you know, assuming they're like in good shape, like in 8 to 10 hours, they'll probably wear off.
Yeah.
But if you're doing it on somebody who has emphysema, COPD, someone who's already like pulmonary compromised, like that's the patient that you don't want to have that happen on. So
now,
let me tell you why.
Let me tell you why it's a big deal though. So when that patient gets that that hemiparalysis or the phrenic nerve palsy or whatever, and they get pissed off because, you know, they're like, oh, I'm short of breath, it hurts, or like, oh, my arm is still numb, oh, like, you know, I can't feel my arm still, and it's like 4 weeks from surgery, and then we're just like, oh, it's the block. They get pissed off at us, and it's really annoying, and then they like give you negative reviews and they give you negative Prescani scores, and we have to explain to them like, yeah, it's the block, I didn't do it, but I mean, technically.
Are you talking about actual nerve palsies and you know, complications from the block itself, or just the diaphragmatic?
All of the above.
Okay.
Basically, any complication from the block or any adverse effect from the block. So there's a lot of surgeons. I'm not in that camp yet, but there's a lot of surgeons that will just say no to every single block because they don't want to deal with the patients having adverse effects from the block. And I had a story actually from fellowship where. It was kind of funny, actually. There was a pain fellow, and I was the fellow, and my attending was there. And I think they were doing maybe an adductor canal block or something for an ACL. I don't remember. Basically, the lady filed a complaint with patient services because she got mad because she told my attending that she wanted him to do every part of the procedure. And the pain fellow did the block because, of course, we don't do blocks. She got pissed off because she said he promised that he would do every part of the procedure when there was a resident doing the block for her. And he obviously, he's like, first of all, I had nothing to do with this. You need to talk to the anesthesia faculty. This is outside of my department. I can't control them or whatever. But I think it was funny because it just highlights how patients really blame us for every little thing that goes wrong with their surgery. And it really is on us because we're the ones authorizing the block. We're the ones letting it happen. So that's my problem with blocks. Is there any anesthesiologist in the world that will actually take responsibility for something like that?
Wow, that's some fire.
So the complaints that if you get like something actually go, like the most common complication from a block is that it doesn't work. For whatever reason.
We get blamed,
right?
For that too.
Yeah, but things like, you know, you told me you're going to do everything. That's just poor understanding on the patient's part of reality of the thing is, right?
For sure. That was more funny than serious, but
yeah, like there's no cure for that. Like, if you have a distribution that matches with what you did with the block, right?
Mm-hmm.
With a curve covering certain nerve roots or whatever. Yeah. Like, yeah, I mean, there's plenty of lawsuits that have happened where the anesthesiologist gets roped into that because there was a complication in which it was the block's fault. There's not like, you know, it's not a huge incidence. Like I never had that happen anytime I've done a block, but not to say that it
doesn't
happen.
You've seen.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen it happen maybe to other people, mm-hmm. but in my own practice, it's never happened to me. And, you know, we did like hundreds of these things. Like I saw maybe one or two patients that had some sort of nerve damage or something like that. Actually, one of our attendings, he had a knee surgery done, and he had permanent like saphenous distribution, like numbness.
Yeah.
For like years, a year or two afterwards. And he was like a hockey player. He couldn't play hockey again. So he was pissed. Yeah. So he was just very careful whenever he's doing the blocks. Now, look, it's gonna happen to somebody. You know, that's the sad reality. There's a cost benefit analysis, and you as the provider, like me as an anesthesiologist who's doing the block, has to educate the patient. Like, look, these are the risks associated with doing this, and not really skate on those risks.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds right. Sounds about right. All right, Sonny. We ask all of our guests one last question, and The question is, what is your favorite bone? And I know you're not an orthopedic surgeon, but you can still have a favorite bone. So what is your favorite bone?
Okay, let's see. Favorite bone. Man, that's a random ass question. Let me see. I'll say, you know, as a pain physician, you know, I'll say, you know, L4, cartilage. L5. Oh. Yeah.
Or hyoid. Hyoid would be a good one too.
Cricohyoid.
Yeah.
The mandible. Right?
I'll say the L5 vertebra.
Oh.
All right. That's a good one. Yeah, that's the first time we've had someone name a
spine.
Spinal bone. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, that's the only shit I looked at during fellowship. It's like just vertebra.
Yeah, that sounds good. All right. Thanks, Sonny, for spending your time with us. We really appreciate your insight. And yeah, we'll do it again sometime.
No problem. Anytime you guys want to talk shop on anesthesia.
And you can still do my blocks, man. No.
Yeah, you can just get my X-Pro blocks through. Like. All right.
All right. Thanks, Sonny. And that'll do it for this week. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Hope you guys learned a little something about anesthesiology and how it relates to orthopedics. If you guys like what you're listening to, please give us 5 stars on your favorite podcasting platform, whether that's iTunes, Spotify, or any other podcasting platform you're using. If you want to listen to any of our other episodes, you can do so at our website, orthotalkpod.com, or you can follow us on Twitter at orthotalkpod. If you don't like what we're doing, please don't leave us a stupid review on iTunes. Just shoot us an email and tell us what we're doing wrong. theorthopodcast@gmail.com. You can watch the webinar, or it's not a webinar. You can watch the webcast of all of our interviews and see our beautiful faces on video on our YouTube channel, The Ortho Talk Podcast on YouTube. So hope you guys enjoy what we're doing. We'll have more for you. Hopefully no more anesthesia delays in the future. And thank you for the opportunity.